The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Tubulointerstitial disease is presented by Dr. Mark Baldwin.
So this is tubular interstitial problems. 49-year-old white male presents following for a new patient. She has a history of hypertension when she takes valsartan that was made in the United States, by the way. She has GERD for when she takes omeprazole. She's a non-smoker and drinks rarely. Physical exam is unremarkable, other than her blood pressure is on the higher end than we'd like to see it, and she has some mild obesity. We have her lab here, her BUN and creatinine are 33 and 2.9. Specific gravity of the urine is unremarkable, but she does have leukocyte esterase and 4 to 10 white cells per high power field. They did a culture and this was negative. This is a classic presentation of chronic interstitial nephritis. Frequently we see these patients that are being diagnosed with recurrent UTIs when in fact they don't have an infectious process, they have an inflammatory process. So how do we differentiate tubular interstitial disease from glomerular disease? Well, tubular interstitial disease don't have much protein. They may have an anemia early on in the course of their disease due to the deficiency of erythropoietin. Acidosis, RTAs are common, hypertension is common. Again, on UA, you're going to see white cells and white cell casts, and you may see abnormalities of potassium and sodium, again, in part due to the RTAs. Glomerular disease, again, you have proteinuria. You have usually anemia and acidosis are late in the course. Hypertension may occur. And UAs are usually fairly unremarkable in nephrotic syndrome. All we'll see is oval fat bodies. So types of interstitial disease, acute interstitial nephritis, which I spoke about, chronic interstitial nephritis, which I'll go into a little more, ATN, which I discussed earlier. So chronic interstitial nephritis is a chronic condition involving fibrosis of the interstitium, leading to tubular destruction. We see chronic low-grade inflammation, which leads to tubular injury and subsequent fibrosis. Macroscopically, the kidneys are gonna look okay early on. And again, this is the final common pathway of all other types of kidney disease. If you have permanent glomerular injury, it's gonna be passed downstream. The tubules will be reabsorbed, undergo apoptosis. People who have obstruction that finally gets relieved are going to have residual scarring that we call chronic interstitial nephritis. So we have a lot of things that can cause this, and you can read the list as well as I can. A couple things I want to point out. Radiation. Radiation and chronic interstitial nephritis is really woefully underappreciated. We can see this also as a component of things like Sjogren's syndrome and sarcoidosis, and we see it's related to erythropoietic acid. Years ago, they described a condition called Balkan endemic nephropathy, and this was a chronic interstitial nephritis, which led to chronic kidney disease. Slowly over a period of time, that they didn't have the usual risk factors. They were not diabetic and they weren't hypertensive. What they found was chronic exposure to erythropoietic acid through some of the plants that people consumed in the Balkans. About 25, 30 years ago, there was a new herb on the market called Ma Wong that was great for weight loss. You lost weight, mainly because you went into acute kidney injury, which is not the best way. Dr. Pryor and I have actually taken care of some cases with this, and this had large amounts, again, of this aristolochic acid, which led to the what we call Chinese herb nephropathy. So this is an example of, and this will be in your, this is in your slide deck, of the acute and chronic exposure, which led to chronic inflammation and fibrosis of the kidneys. So clinical features of chronic interstitial nephritis, usually asymptomatic. They have sterile pyuria, which is the hallmark of chronic interstitial nephritis. Anemia, RTAs, hypo or hyperkalemia, minimal proteinuria, and hypertension. This is a photo of chronic interstitial nephritis. And again, what we see here, we don't see a lot of tubules, and we see a lot of fibrotic tissue here. So, and again, this is just another example here. Treatment, don't give antibiotics for pyuria, okay? If they have a culture, it's positive, treat the culture. Again, this is a chronic inflammatory condition. Most important thing you can do for the patient is getting their blood pressure under control. ACEs or ARBs, especially if they have excess of 500 milligrams of protein a day, are the treatment of choice. Acidosis, anemia, and phosphate control in late stages are important. RTAs, I'm gonna give you the Cliff's Notes to RTAs, because they love to ask these on boards too. Distal type 1 RTA, we see this with obstruction, we see this with chronic infection, we see this with AMPHO-B. The differentiation of this, the bicarb is less than 15. They'll have hypokalemia, and the urine pH is inordinately elevated. Generally, if you have too much acid, you pee it out. These patients have too much acid, but because they can't acidify their urine, the urine pH is going to be abnormally high. Proximal type 2 RTA, we see this with Fanconi syndrome. We can see this with amyloid. The serum bicarb, they have a mild acidosis, but it's going to be above 15. They'll have a normal anion gap and hypokalemia. The best way to differentiate the two is in part based on their serum bicarbonate level. Type 4, this is the most common RTA classically associated with diabetics. They have a normal anion gap, metabolic acidosis, hyperkalemia. For those of you that are still in your residencies and you want to a pressure attending on wards, if you have somebody who has some mild CKD and a mild metabolic acidosis and potassium in the upper end of 5, you can say, well, they classically have a type 4 RTA. And immediately you'll go into territory that nobody else knows about except nephrologist. One of the other things is talking about the urinary anion gap, which I may add is a relatively worthless test, except they keep it alive on board exams. If your urinary anion gap is positive, they have an RTA. If it's negative, they have diarrhea, okay? End of discussion. We'll move on, okay? So this just a little more on the urinary anion gap. Multiple myeloma. This is something that before you take your, for those of you who are taking the board exam for the first time, read a good review article of multiple myeloma, because I can guarantee you there's going to be a handful of questions on it. They love to ask about myeloma. We see myeloma affects the kidneys. This is about 10% of all malignancies. Again, it's a plasma cell clone of immunoglobulins, usually in the form of IgG. You have renal, cardiac, and liver involvement, the big three. Renal impairment can be acute, can be chronic, and is seen in about half the cases, with severe involvement in 15 to 20% of cases. Proteinuria, it can be either globulin or albumin. Classically, you'll see a negative dip for urine, and in fact, they'll have 5 grams of protein because it's all albumin. How we diagnose this is put a couple drops of sulfasalicylic acid, and it'll precipitate this white gunk, and that because that precipitates all protein. And it can pretty much involve any segment of the kidney. Generally, if you have kidney problems associated with myeloma, your mortality and morbidity skyrockets. Again, It involves light chain fragments to get deposited in the tissue. Lambda or kappa light chains, amyloid can be deposited. You can have obstruction. You can have tubular dysfunction with Fanconi syndrome and proximal RTA. And you can have acute kidney injury of multiple etiologies. So how the myeloma affects the kidneys, you can get light chain deposition or heavy chain amyloidosis. You can get light chain deposition disease or heavy chain deposition disease, plasma cell infiltration, tubular cast. The classic myeloma kidney is where the tubule gets gunked up with myeloma proteins that latch on to the hyaline cast, and you have an intratubular obstruction. You can have hypercalcemia, hyperuricemia, and they're prone to contrast. Interstitial, again, you can have plasma cell infiltration, and because their immunity is impaired, they're prone to infection, so they can present with pilo. Quick way to differentiate the amyloid from light chain deposition. In amyloid myeloma, they have more kappa compared to lambda. They'll stain positive for Congo red, and they'll see fibrils on electron microscopy. I'll show you a picture in a minute. Light chain deposition disease, they have more kappa versus lambda. Congo red will be negative, and there won't be any fibrils on electron microscopy. Cast nephropathy, most common cause of renal failure in myeloma. Again, the globulin light chains are filtered to the glomerulus. Patients can, in full-blown myeloma, can excrete up to 10, 20 grams of protein in the urine a day. We know that protein is toxic to the tubules, so you're getting this kind of double whammy. You have a damaged filter, but you have toxins within the tubule in the form of the protein that are poisoning the interstitial cells. Obstructing cast can lead to inflammation, fibrosis, and tubular rupture. Who's at risk? Men greater than 50. African Americans are more prone as compared to other groups. They may have a long history of back pain or arthritic pain. They may have pathological fractures, fatigue, anemia, infection, or present with acute kidney injury. We diagnose this by an elevated BUN and creatinine. They can present with hypercalcemia, hypercalciuria. They'll have a normocytic, normochromic anemia, and you'll see Rouleau formation. This is another thing that's been known to show up on exams. Obviously, we screen this with a serum and urine protein electrophoresis. And again, we're looking for a spike, usually a gamma fraction of the IgM spike. We have a low urine anion gap. And urinalysis, again, as I mentioned, may have no protein on dipstick, but in fact, they may have a lot because of we see precipitation with sulfasalicylic acid. So again, this is, if we have a positive electrophoresis, the next thing we do is order a light chain assay and immunofixation, which tells us what type of immunoglobulins are involved. End up doing cytogenic analysis and karyotyping and flow cytometry to help differentiate this for the oncologist. This is the classic apple green birefringence we see with a Congo red stain. This is due to amyloid staining. And then this is a picture of, this is a PAS stain, and you see the large deposition of amyloid. It looks like pink bubble gum here. And this is an example of cast nephropathy here. Again, we have the amyloid deposition and cast nephropathy. These are the fibrils I was talking about here. They look like, you know, little twigs here. And again, this is seen, we see these fibrils with amyloidosis, with myeloma, and a thing called fibrillary glomerulonephritis. Radiographs, this is about the only time you'd want to order a cross table of the skull other than looking for a foreign body, is it looks like somebody took a Black and Decker and drilled holes in their head. So treatment, obviously the big thing is assuring hydration, try to alkalize the urine, but again, try to avoid the fluid overload. Allopurinol, bortezomib, dexamethasone, and cyclophosphamide, or Borzdumab, thalidomide, dexamethasone to decrease light chain production and may improve cast nephropathy. Dialysis if needed, but generally the outcomes in patients who have reached the state where they need to be dialyzed, the outcome is very poor. So you really need to be talking to the patients about, you know, other type of comfort measures. So hypercalcemia malignancy, this is another favorite that shows up on boards. Again, these are the big tumors that cause this. It's a very poor prognostic feature. They virtually always present with dehydration. This could be due to direct bone invasion, osteolysis, elevated parathyroid hormone receptor protein, hypercalcemia of malignancy. This is due to cytokine production and excessive of calcitriol-like factors, which leads to increased calcium absorption in the gut. We see with sarcoidosis excess of calcitriol substance, which leads to hypercalcemia with this also. Almost always they present with two things, mental status change and severe dehydration. This is an example that shows the mechanisms of hypercalcemia of malignancy and then some of the ones that are more classically the tumors associated with this. How do we treat this? We still, when they present with dehydration, we still hydrate them. We hydrate them to perfuse the kidney, perfuse the rest of the body, but also by delivering more sodium to the kidney will not take up as much calcium in the proximal tubule. Once they're hydrated, we can give them a loop diuretic, calcitonin, bisphosphonates, steroids, and denobosub. So these are the interventions. This is the onset, and this is the duration and effectiveness of each of the interventions. So in conclusion, in talking about tubular interstitial problems, these are kind of the Rodney Dangerfields of nephrology. It's frequently overlooked as a cause of chronic kidney disease. Look for some type of cause, namely drug causes, sepsis, or acute kidney injury where they haven't fully recovered, and they're going to have electrolyte abnormalities, acid-base problems, and anemia at relatively minor elevations of the creatinine.